From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Hurricane Dorian slammed into the Bahamas last weekend as a Category 5 hurricane, then stalled and sat there for 2 days, leaving Grand Bahama and Abaco Islands devastated, many areas flattened, and large portions of the islands underwater. Dorian was the second strongest Atlantic hurricane on record, and also the second slowest moving. And that makes it part of a trend. One study last year found that over the past 70 years, Atlantic hurricanes have gotten more likely to stall, and that leads to more extreme rainfall and can also make it harder to predict where the storms will go. Tim Hall is a senior scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and co-author of that study. Tim, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks for having me.
This stalling out of hurricanes is something that seems to have become increasingly common just in the past few years. I mean, if you think about storms like Florence and Harvey, but you've seen a longer trend in your research, 70 years. How pronounced is this trend?
That's right. The trend is noisy, but it stands out and it stands up to all the tests we've thrown at it. And roughly speaking, if you look at the first third of that period and compare it to the last third, the most recent third, we've seen about a 60% increase in the frequency of events like Dorian stalling near the coast, or in fact, stalling anywhere in the North Atlantic.
So, Tim Hall, this study documents the trend in whether or not hurricanes stall, right? That's just looking empirically at the hurricane data that we have. But do we understand what makes a hurricane stall?
That's a great question. The immediate answer is that the particular meteorological conditions are set up to cause that stall. Hurricanes are kind of like corks on a stream. They're being pushed along by the large-scale wind patterns in the atmosphere. And sometimes those wind patterns just collapse before they change into different patterns. It's basically what we call weather. And when that happens, the storm, sort of imagine a cork moving into an eddy in the stream, and it doesn't have any guidance, and it just kind of bobs around locally until it gets caught up by a new wind pattern. So every time you have a stalling event, Dorian, Florence, Harvey, you can see some kind of scenario like that. But the longer-term view is what might be causing trends in those scenarios. And although we're not certain, and it's really at the cutting edge of research right now, and what we can say about the climate-hurricane relationship, we do indeed have a culprit, and the culprit is related to a slowdown in large-scale atmospheric wind patterns, likely due to a warming climate. So there is a climate change signal there. Although I should say, it's probably a climate change signal that's the least well understood of all the aspects of hurricane-climate relationship.
So when it comes to whether or not a hurricane stalls, it sounds like we're talking about much broader atmospheric conditions, not characteristics of the hurricane, of the storm itself. And then likewise, in terms of this long-term trend and whether or not it's related to climate change, again, that's related to changes in, you know, the jet stream and in weather patterns more broadly, not changes in how hurricanes are forming or functioning as a relation to climate change.
Right. Hurricanes are subject to the conditions of the environment in which they find themselves, and they are pushed along by these large-scale wind patterns. The jet stream is one example in middle latitudes. Dorian was a stall in the subtropics, but there are wind patterns in the subtropics too that and they appear to be slowing down. Climate change simulations show pretty robustly that going forward, these tropical wind patterns are slowing down, but also even over the past several decades, they've been slowing down. And hurricanes are responding to that.
Of course, we've also seen, in addition to whether or not hurricanes stall, Dorian is the fifth Category 5 hurricane in the Atlantic in 4 years, setting a record for the longest running streak, I guess you would call it, the longest number of consecutive years of having a Category 5 hurricane form in the Atlantic. And that seems to be a pretty clear, or very consistent at least, with what is expected on the basis of climate change.
That's right. I mean, I like to look at the climate change hurricane relationship is a kind of a hierarchy from what we know best to what we have some suspects about, but is a little bit less certain. And what we know best is that sea level is rising, and that exacerbates coastal flooding due to storm surge, even if other aspects of hurricanes weren't changing. And it did, that's the most robust projection of a changing climate. Nearly as robust as the fact that hurricanes will rain more, are raining more. And that's simply because warmer air in a warmer climate holds more water in vapor form. So when the conditions are right, like they are in a hurricane, it dumps that water vapor as rain. But just below that is something you're alluding to. And there's a strong consensus now in the scientific community that studies hurricanes that the increasing heat content of ocean water in a warming climate is fueling greater intensification. Not necessarily more storms. In fact, there's really no evidence globally that there are going to be more storms year on year. But the ones that do form are likely to reach the highest levels of intensity, or more likely than in the past.
I mean, if you put all of that together, it's not a pretty picture. I mean, you're talking more of these Category 5 hurricanes, as you said, not more total storms, but just more likely to have these more intense storms, storms that carry and therefore can dump more rain, and then more likely to stall, giving them even more time for those stronger winds and more rain to wreak havoc, exactly as we saw with Dorian. I mean, is this really a glimpse of what we should be expecting more of going forward?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm the bringer of bad news, and I'm afraid it is. You know, at least for, you know, the foreseeable next few decades, as the climate continues to warm, these hurricane hazard variables are going to respond in the way you just described. I mean, you know, it's a noisy signal. So one year you may have a lot of intense hurricanes, and next year it may be quiet. There's certainly internal variability, which causes year-to-year changes that are not climate change-driven. But the long-term trend appears to be clear.
Tim Hall, in the study where you looked at this long-term trend in hurricanes becoming more likely to stall, you also note that hurricanes that stall tend to be more unpredictable, or they tend to sometimes take these sharp turns in their paths and be harder to predict. I mean, in my mind, if there's a silver lining to a hurricane compared to other forms of extreme weather, it's always been the fact that you get a fair bit of warning about it. But it sounds like maybe we should rethink that as well, that it's going to get harder to predict hurricanes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Hurricanes that stall tend to be more difficult to forecast. It's not surprising, because once the storm stalls, where is it going to move in that stalling period? I mean, it's stalling, so it's in a confined region, but it could meander back and forth, like, say, Harvey did, onto land, and it'll attenuate if it's over land, but then back over ocean, where it strengthens and picks up more evaporation to dump as rain. But those sort of meanderings are difficult to forecast, because there are no large-scale guiding winds to push the hurricane along a trajectory. And it's the large-scale features that are easiest to forecast. The very small-scale features that depend just on the local environment and the dynamics of the hurricane itself tend to be more difficult to forecast. So a stalling hurricane is also a more difficult hurricane to forecast. That's true.
I mean, altogether, again, as you said, you're kind of the bearer of bad news. This is not an encouraging picture. And it feels like, to some degree, the conversation around hurricanes and climate change may also have stalled a little bit, that every time we get one of these big storms, and there have been a fair number of them in the past few years, we end up in this same loop of, is this climate change? And the next question, I guess, would be, is there anything we can do about that? I mean, how do we respond to this growing knowledge that, yes, storms are getting stronger, they're dumping more rain, they may be stalling and doing more damage more frequently? What do we do with that knowledge?
Well, I think it's a complicated question, absolutely. I think there's a short-term answer and a longer-term answer. I mean, the shorter-term answer is, regardless of the cause of these intense storms, I mean, people in harm's way, you know, just need to adapt somehow to put in emergency disaster planning situations, to develop building codes that allow for increases in these types of catastrophes. And that happens. That's happening by fits and spurts too, and maybe not as consistently as you'd like to see, but it does happen. Building codes over time get increasingly stringent. Of course, more and more people want to live by the coast, so that kind of counteracts the trend in more resilient buildings. The longer term picture, yes, has to do with climate change and the business as usual carbon dioxide emissions scenario, fossil fuel usage scenario that we continue to be on, exacerbates the problem decade by decade. If we stopped emitting fossil fuels tomorrow, which is highly unlikely, the climate actually would still go on warming for a couple of decades because the oceans take much longer to respond to the forcing from human emissions than does the atmosphere. And it's the oceans are fueling this intensification of the storms. So it's going to be a problem. It's going to be an increasing problem for decades to come. So really, the answer, in the long run is you still want to bend the curve down as best you can by, reducing fossil fuel emissions. But you also need to talk about, more resilient structures on the coast, possibly retreating from various parts of coastlines and islands that might well become uninhabitable when you couple the hurricane changes with rising sea levels.
Of course, these kinds of conversations and thinking about that long term are very difficult, if not completely impossible, for communities, the Bahamas in the wake of this disaster and communities that are facing the immediate threat of a hurricane or the immediate aftermath of a major hurricane. And there's sometimes a criticism that this conversation about the longer term responses should perhaps wait. What's your response to that?
I'd like to think we can do both. I don't think it's an either or kind of situation. It's a false dichotomy to say, well, let's just look at the short term and set aside the longer term. We should be able to talk about, what's going to come in terms of increased frequency of catastrophes, next decade and the one after, because we build structures that we hope last that long. At the same time, talk about how are we going to better respond to catastrophes now to protect people in harm's way, to, improve the chances that they're going to get out of there safely and have a place to go, at least temporarily. So I think we need to try to do both. I don't see it as either or.
Timothy Hall is a senior scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, studying trends in hurricane strength and their propensity to stall, at least in the Atlantic Ocean. Tim, thanks so much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Up next, what 9,000 studies have revealed about the biology of chronic fatigue syndrome. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Chronic fatigue syndrome. It was first described in the early 1980s, and it affects an estimated 2.5 million Americans. But for many years, doctors' tests couldn't find an explanation for the symptoms of inexplicable tiredness and often pain. And those symptoms were often written off as figments of patients' imaginations. But that's changing. My next guest recently wrote about advances in understanding chronic fatigue syndrome in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Anthony Komaroff is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a senior physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and editor-in-chief of Harvard Health Letter. Anthony, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you, Heather. Great to be here.
I should start by saying that, in fact, chronic fatigue syndrome has actually gotten an updated name as well. Can you just kind of tell us what this syndrome is, what is considered chronic fatigue syndrome at this point by the medical community?
The illness is defined by a series of symptoms. Fatigue is a prominent symptom. Pain, as you said. A tendency after physical exertion or cognitive exertion to have a relapse of the fatigue and the pain and the other symptoms. Often not immediately, but the next day. something called orthostatic intolerance, which basically means the blood pressure is not being properly controlled by the brain. And as a result, people often feel faint or even do faint after they've been up on their feet a period of time. So there are a group of symptoms together. They must have been present at least 6 months. And in most of the people that I've seen in my practice and that others have seen, they've been ill for many years.
And you write in the Journal of the American Medical Association that over the past 35 years, thousands of studies from laboratories in many countries have documented underlying biological abnormalities in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome compared to healthy peers of the same age. So what are some of those? Because for a long time, that was kind of the crux of the issue, was doctors saying, we've tested everything we can test and we don't find anything wrong. What do we now know is wrong for some of these patients, at least?
Right. And you're right. Initially, a lot of doctors, myself included, would do the usual laboratory tests that are done to screen for some evidence that there's something wrong in the body. And the usual tests didn't show anything. But that was 35 years ago. Over the last 35 years, there have been over 9,000 scientific publications, as you say, that compare people with the illness to healthy people of the same age and sex, and that find a whole variety of abnormalities. The first involves the brain. The autonomic nervous system leads out of the brain and spreads throughout the body and controls vital functions like the blood pressure, the heart rate, digestion, etc. And that also is abnormal in when it's tested in various ways.
And then there are also changes in metabolism and also in the immune system, correct?
Right. Metabolism, particularly energy metabolism. That is, we get our energy because the cells of our body are able to make energy, and they need to do that in order to function, in order for us to function. And the ability of the cells of our body in people with this illness to make energy and to use energy to do the things that the cells need to do seems to be compromised in a wide variety of ways. The immune system, as you say, is also abnormal, particularly if there were one sort of simple thing to say about it. The immune system is like in a state of being chronically activated. It's as if the immune system were going to war against something, but what that something is hasn't been determined, and it might in fact be different from one person to the next. There also recently, in the last 5 years, have been changes found in the bacteria in the gut.
Anthony Komaroff, you've listed a whole bunch of different things here, you know, changes in the brain, changes in the immune system, in the metabolism, even in the bacteria in our gut. Is there at this point any unifying theory or idea of what is going on? Maybe what is the initial trigger, whether chronic fatigue syndrome starts in one place and spreads to all of those? How do you tie all of these different changes together?
Heather, you're right to say that's the big question. These things must be tied together somehow. What ties them together? What explains ultimately the symptoms of the illness? Here's a theory that I think many of us find increasingly supported by scientific studies, although it's not yet proven. There is probably in every patient with this illness a final common pathway that gets triggered in the brain that leads the brain to experience the symptoms of the illness. What triggers that final common pathway? It appears that in many people, perhaps most, inflammation somewhere in the body, either directly in the brain itself or elsewhere in the body, that sends signals to the brain, leads the brain's immune system to get activated. And in the course of that activation, the immune system in the brain makes chemicals that lead to the symptoms of the illness. So if we had a way, for example, if we had a treatment that could quiet down the activated immune system in the brain, that could be a fundamental treatment, even a curative treatment. And there are people working on that. But right now, the treatments that are used are treatments to deal with the symptoms of the illness rather than to get at the heart of the illness.
Anthony Komaroff, as a physician, someone who you've said has encountered and treated patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, it seems that at the heart of this issue, at least for a long time, was the fact that doctors took the attitude that if they couldn't see what was wrong, literally, or, you know, see it in the sense of a blood test that came back outside of the normal range, then they kind of dismissed it. I mean, if you had to diagnose the problem in the medical system as opposed to just diagnosing chronic fatigue syndrome, what was going wrong there, and has that been corrected?
Yeah, well, it's an important question. You know, when a patient walks into a doctor's office, what the patient expects, what the doctor expects, is that the doctor will be able to make a diagnosis of what's wrong, and based on that diagnosis, pick the right treatment to fix the problem. That's what's expected. But when a patient walks into a doctor's office with symptoms that the doctor doesn't understand, and the doctor orders a few tests, and none of them come back abnormal, then there's a problem. And I am afraid that some doctors respond to that problem by saying, well, I've got a problem if I can't make the diagnosis. I don't like to have a problem. So let's make it the patient's problem. Let's say that the patient really doesn't have the symptoms that they say they have, and that they really don't have anything measurably wrong in their body. And therefore, I couldn't be expected to fix it because it doesn't really exist. I think that psychological reaction on the part of some doctors, and not a very healthy reaction, did characterize, and still does, but less often, the way some doctors respond. Many doctors still don't know that there are over 9,000 studies in the published scientific literature that show that there is something wrong in the body, and they order their usual tests. The usual tests come back normal, and they say there's nothing wrong. That does not happen, fortunately, today as often as it did 30 years ago, but it still happens, and when it does, it's really not fair to the patients.
On the bright side, the National Institutes of Health have expanded research efforts and funding for chronic fatigue syndrome research. Where are those resources and that effort going right now?
Well, the National Institutes of Health really supports research in two ways. They do research on their own campus in Bethesda, Maryland, outside of Washington, and they have launched a very large study of patients with this illness. But most of what the National Institutes of Health does is provide financial support to four centers really around the country, and individual grants to individual scientists around the country. And that number has about doubled in the last 2 to 3 years. So there is increasing interest and support from the National Institutes of Health to try to figure out this illness.
I mean, as we were just talking about, with the slow change and still incomplete change in the medical community's attitude toward chronic fatigue syndrome, the additional research and funding from the National Institutes of Health would seem to suggest an attitude change. Do you think there are broader lessons that both the research and medical community can learn from so far 35 years of misunderstanding and increasing understanding of chronic fatigue syndrome?
There's something every medical student is taught in medical school, which is a statement, an aphorism by a Boston physician in the early 20th century, which is, listen to the patient. The patient is telling you the diagnosis. And we all nod our heads and then we go about our business, and sometimes we forget that sage advice. And my lesson in my experience with this illness is when patients are telling you that there's something wrong, and they're very credible people, and you're persuaded that they're telling you what they are really experiencing, believe them and try to figure out why they are suffering in that way.
That's Anthony Komaroff of Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Anthony, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. If you're anything like me, you might be tempted to think of fall as the end of the gardening and landscaping season. Time to rake the leaves, clear out the veggie beds, and wrap it all up. And that's definitely part of it. But there's a lot more to fall gardening than just that. There are bulbs, of course. It's also a good time for planting trees and shrubs, and it may be the right time to set the stage, maybe even literally sow the seeds for certain types of gardens or ecosystems in preparation for next spring. Uli Lorimer is director of horticulture at the Native Plants Trust, formerly the New England Wildflower Society. Uli, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Let's start with some of the traditional fall activities. Some of these, as there's been growing recognition that, of course, our yards, our flower beds, our veggie gardens, even the containers that are in our yards are essentially parts of ecosystems, that maybe some of the things we've always done before aren't quite right. And raking leaves and what to do with leaves has become more of a question. I mean, what's your recommendation? Do you rake? Do you leave them in place to let them fertilize the soil and mulch the ground? What do you recommend with leaves?
Well, specifically with leaves, I mean, I think to start off with, I very much agree with your assessment that gardens are more than just a pretty landscape. They are part of a larger whole, and that increasingly we treat our gardens and the maintenance of our gardens with a much more holistic approach in terms of thinking of how the activities that we do can benefit not just the plants, but also the insects and the wildlife and the birds and everything that's connected to our landscapes. So to answer your question about leaves are actually part of this important nutrient cycling in forests. And we here at Garden in the Woods absolutely let the leaves lay where they may, because they will feed all the organisms in the soil and break down and provide available nutrients for all of your spring plants to grow and for next season.
Will that not actually kill the grass if you're to do that in kind of a lawn setting?
There is a sort of aesthetic choices and aesthetic preferences that people have, and that lawn grasses, for the most part, if you're using traditional lawn grasses, will not like to be covered in lots and lots of leaves. However, I would say if you're going to rake up or collect the leaves, then put them into your flower beds rather than putting them into bags and sending them away. Keep as much of those resources on site as possible.
Let's turn to another thing. This is not necessarily specific to fall, but in that category of things that our attitudes may be changing toward, and that's weeds. And you have an interesting take on weeds, whether or not to pull them or cut them, or maybe just accept that that's what likes to grow in that spot on your property and maybe work with it instead of against it.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I would say necessarily accept that the weeds are there, but I think that weeds can be handled in a much more nuanced approach. Primarily, you should find out what they are, because some of them are perennial, some of them are biennial, meaning they only live 2 years, and some of them are annuals. And if they're annuals, then you just should simply cut them, because if you prevent them from going to seed, they won't come back the next year. The perennial weeds sometimes need a different approach, where maybe pulling them out completely is a better method. But I would also advocate that, you know, nature doesn't like an empty space or a vacuum. So a lot of the weed problems that people have are actually tied in with the kinds of gardening techniques like soil disturbance that bring fresh weed seeds to the surface. And so I would say if you're going to pull weeds, follow up by planting with something desirable in that same spot. and provide competition against the weeds. And if you're persistent, you should be able to have a garden full of all the plants you want and none of them with the plants that you don't want.
Well, and when we go to find something to plant in place of those weeds, give us some ideas on how to start thinking about what maybe should go into that spot and what we should be looking for when we go to the nursery to look for replacements.
Well, so our organization, Native Plant Trust, has been an advocate for New England's flora. So I'm going to take this opportunity to push to plant native plants as much as possible. There are plants that grow in a variety of garden conditions, whether it's sunny and dry or shady and dry or sunny and wet and everything in between. They have also evolved with the sort of interactions and connections with all of the pollinators and butterflies and bees and all the wildlife that you like to see in your garden. There's this really sort of beautiful, tight choreography between insects and plants that has resulted from this coevolution for a long period of time. And using native plants, and particularly plants that are from New England, helps to keep that sort of dance with nature going into the future. You know, pollinators don't just pollinate wildflowers, they also pollinate all your vegetables.
Right.
And without pollinators, you would not have vegetables to eat and enjoy all summer long. So planting them in combinations with one another is a great way to enjoy the beauty of flowers and to have plenty of food for your plate.
Well, Uli Lorimer, since it is September and we're looking at fall here, are there certain types of plants, whether it's food plants or flowers, that now is actually the right time to think about planting?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning planting trees and shrubs, and I think this is a good place to think about setting in some of those native trees, oaks, for example. We can't have enough oaks. Flowering trees like dogwoods and redbuds are great things to put in to the garden at this time of year, along with flowering shrubs like viburnums are all really great choices to set into the garden now and something that you will enjoy for years and years to come. Certainly, if you want to have a good bulb display for the springtime, now is the time to begin thinking about planting some of those. In terms of native plants, one of the other good things that you could do is you can also begin to collect seed from your native plants.
Ah, yes. I was going to ask about that idea of actually collecting seeds in the fall when, of course, so many plants are, you know, winding down their season and putting out seeds.
Yes, and that's correct. And so collecting seeds is a really wonderful economical way to make sure that you have more of the plants that you like in your gardens the next year. Many of them can be directly sown into the soil and will happily grow without a whole lot of effort. And it's a great way to share with your neighbors, too.
Well, speaking of neighbors and wildflowers in particular, I have a neighbor who wants to turn a large chunk of her currently lawn into a wildflower, native wildflower meadow to help support pollinators, but also just because it would be beautiful. And she was saying that she might need to actually do some prep work this fall, perhaps plant a cover crop to help that changeover from grass to wildflowers. Any advice there?
Yes. So, I mean, it's a good time of year to make those transitions. And it's something that I'm very happy to hear that people are interested in converting portions of their lawn into wildflower meadows. In terms of the fall, the first step is going to be to try to get rid of the existing lawn. And using a cover crop is actually a really great idea to provide some competition so that you don't end up with a lot of weeds instead. So we like to recommend sowing partridge pea, a bean family member. It's a wonderful annual, and it's very colorful. It has beautiful yellow blossoms, and if you put the seeds out now, you'll have lots and lots of good color in the beginning of the spring while you then move to the next step of setting in your native grasses and wildflowers and go through the rest of the meadow establishments.
Uli Lorimer, the Native Plants Trust has a great resource, whether people are trying to figure out, you know, whether that weed is an annual or perennial, what to do with it, or actually to find something to replace weeds or transition your lawn to. You've got this resource, Go Botany. Can you tell us a little bit about what people can find there and how it might help them out with some of these choices?
Absolutely. So Go Botany is a sort of interactive website that we've developed over the last couple of years. And it, as you said, a wealth of information about all of the plants that grow in New England. So both the non-native ones and weeds. So if you want to know what your weed is, you can discover or find the answer there, as well as all of the native plants that are here. And it's set up in a way that it has a very simple key so that, let's say, you can say, is it a tree? Does it have flowers? And it'll kind of narrow down the options for you. But it's also a really great resource for professionals. So if you're a botanist, you can also go to Go Botany and find out very good specific sort of technical information.
Uli Lorimer is Director of Horticulture at the Native Plants Trust, formerly the New England Wildflower Society. Uli, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Up next, it's ridiculous science-based advice for real-life problems from the creator of XKCD. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Physics is all around us every day, whether or not we choose to think about it. Every time we pick something up, throw a ball, charge our cell phones, or drive a car. Now a new book aims to get us thinking about exactly what is happening when we do those kinds of things and some of the ridiculous physics-based ways that we might address some everyday problems. Randall Monroe is the author of the webcomic XKCD, and his new book is How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Randall, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with what has to be my favorite chapter in the whole book. It's advice on how to be on time, which is a perennial struggle in my household. And you give the two options that most of us think of, either leaving earlier or moving a little bit more quickly along your route to wherever you're going. And then you say, yeah, no, those are too mundane. Here's a third option. Alter the flow of time. And for something that I didn't think was even possible, you managed to write a whole chapter about it. So give us some ideas. If we're not going to leave earlier, we're not going to travel any faster, how can we alter the flow of time to be on time?
Well, time has always been really like fascinating to me because it's very weird. But one way of, you know, there's altering time and then there's altering timekeeping. And the way, because it's weird to realize that like the days of the week are completely a social construct. You know, if people all like fell asleep for some number of days and then woke up and, you know, we didn't have a calendar, a table, astronomical information, like there's nothing about the world that says that it has to be Saturday right now, you know, or Sunday or whatever. And so you can just change it. We could all agree that it was going to be a different time. And the U.S. does this all the time. Twice a year, we change our clocks. We just decide it's now no longer 2 in the morning, it's 3 in the morning. And everyone goes along with it. And that always, you know, seemed really strange to me. And so I started researching, what are the laws around this? If you want to change what time it is, what do you need to do? Who do you need to talk to? And I was surprised to find, like, every country can kind of set its own clocks however it wants. There's no central body that regulates it all. And then everyone who does keeps track of time in different places, like airlines and software developers and stuff, they all just kind of have to do their best to keep up.
There, you have another chapter on how to dig a hole. And again, in this case, you take that to extremes that most of us would never think of, which really made me wonder where your intense interest in digging really big holes actually came from.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I loved to play in the sand as a little kid, and I would dig holes. I always did worry about, you know, I knew that if you dig too big a hole, it can easily, like, surprise and collapse on you. So I would dig a little ways, you know, but I never wanted to dig them too deep. But I was kind of interested in, like, does the sand keep going? What do you hit if you dig further? And so I got to write a chapter where I could explore that from the safety of the surface.
Now, Randall Monroe, in How To, one of the things that in How To you are, you know, often walking through the physics and with your comic drawing, your drawing style that you use in XKCD. But in a couple of cases, you turned to perhaps unexpected experts. And I'm thinking in particular of your chapter on how to take down a drone with sports equipment, which, again, there's the question of why one might need to do that. But Apparently, this led you to Serena Williams' door, and I'm dying to know if she's actually a secret science geek.
Yeah, I was really surprised because this is one of my favorite things about this book was that I got to reach out to these cool people who I would have assumed had something better to do, but I was really surprised by how enthusiastic people were. When I reached out to them, I had mentioned that I was working on the chapter about tennis her and her husband had been like, I said, oh yeah, whenever, if there's anything we can do to help, sure. And I had been expecting, I said, well, it would be really cool if I could get some accuracy data on hitting targets with a tennis ball. And I had figured she'd just set up a practice, put a piece of tape on the wall and videotape herself during practice, take a couple of serves at it. But not only was she willing to help out, but they were like, we've got an actual drone. Do you want us to just try to take down a drone for you? And I was like, yes, please. That's... I will absolutely would love that. And so we got so her husband took a drone that was broken, Alexis, that had a broken camera, and she stood at the end of the court while he flew it around, and she served at it, and tried to see how many serves it would take from a given distance to knock it out of the air. And I can confirm experimentally that a tennis ball will absolutely knock down one of those wedding photography drones.
At least when it is served by Serena Williams, that may not be a repeatable result for the rest of us.
Yes. But, and also, I had a whole model for how accurate tennis serves, different projectiles and different sports are. And I had a guess for tennis serves. And Serena came in, she hit it, I thought it would take 5 to 7 shots, and she got it on the third shot. That might be an outlier, but I think it might just be that Serena is an outlier. So yeah, your mileage may vary.
Another person that you reached out to is test pilot and astronaut Chris Hatfield, looking for advice on how to make emergency landings. What'd you learn there?
I think... He's flown 100 different aircraft. He's one of the most qualified pilots alive. And I was really excited to just throw ever weirder situations at him and get to hear, what his thoughts and reaction would be. And we could debate whether the situation made sense or whatever. I thought I'd write a normal chapter about, what I had learned from talking to him. But to my surprise, I had collected a list of ridiculous questions, and I thought I'd start with the most, the least ridiculous one and work my way up, figuring that at some point he would just say, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever been asked, and this interview is over, and hang up on me.
So what was your most ridiculous question?
I discovered that I couldn't stump him. I just kept asking weirder and weirder questions, and instead of debating them, he just gave me the answer. He said, here's what I would do in that situation. And he gave it all in a very neutral astronaut air traffic control voice where it sounds like he's just discussing, his plans for the afternoon. And I even got to the weirdest question on my list, which was, what would you do if you are picked up by a rock, the giant mythical bird, and it's carrying you away? How would you force that to the ground? And he even did his best to figure out, here's what I would do in that situation. And and just laid it all out like he was talking to mission control about the next maneuver.
So how do you force a giant, mythical, legendary bird to the ground?
Well, he talked a little bit about how any kind of flying creature or flying object has these basic physical constraints, where if you can get your weight too far forward, it's going to tip forward and it won't be able to help diving down toward the ground. And so if you're able to throw your weight around, you can sort of steer it, like he said, like a big angry hang glider. but then he said, and this is all, again, what was so funny for me was that he just sounded like he was discussing a thing he had done 100 times. He said, yeah, so you might be able to steer it that way. Or if you have some kind of a parachute you can deploy, anything that flies is going to really hate it when you put a lot of drag out there. And it might want to let you go.
Well, Randall Monroe, you describe how to as, and I'm quoting here, a book of bad ideas. I mean, obviously, if you are trying to be on time to an appointment, the better idea is probably to leave earlier rather than attempt to on the fly alter the flow of time or change the legal definition of the day and time. I wonder why you think it is important or worthwhile to think about, write a whole book about, read a whole book about bad ideas.
Well, there are a few reasons. One is that sometimes it's hard to tell what a bad idea is until you've really gone over it. When I'm writing this book, I'm not thinking what's the worst idea I can think of. I'm just trying to think of ideas, and most of them are bad. And so with this, it's like my idea was to take an idea and then like kind of explore it a little bit, because there are some ideas that people have had that definitely sounded really bad right on, you know, the first time they came across them. Like, you know, if you get a bite and it gets infected, putting mold on an infection sounds like the most ridiculous idea imaginable. But that's like how we discovered antibiotics. But most of the ideas in my book are not antibiotics. They're not ideas that secretly turn out to be good. But you can still learn a lot by trying to find out why it is that they're bad. And the things that you learn might be useful for solving some problem later on. And even if it's none of those things, I just think it's really fun.
So how do you come up with the ideas for, you know, whether it's how to dig a hole or take a drone down with sports equipment? Are you thinking about the physics involved and trying to think about a real world situation where a certain set of physical, you know, principles might be involved? Or are you coming up with the questions first?
For a lot of the questions in how to, I took a simple task and I just tried to brainstorm, you know, if it's something that I have to do a lot and it's kind of mundane, like packing up to move or, you know, throwing a party or whatever, I thought about, okay, what are some alternate ways to do this? And then took that and see where those ideas go. In other cases, I came across a really cool piece of research and I thought, I wonder how this could be useful. There are some U.S. government projects from the Cold War era. There was one where they bought a bunch of soda and beer bottles from convenience stores and then tested nuclear weapons on them. And they had a whole reason where it was about checking to see whether drinks would survive a nuclear attack and be useful as a source of hydration in the, you know, after in the search and rescue efforts. And so I had that in the back of my mind, is like, is there a problem that I could solve where it would be helpful to know whether nuclear weapons can break open bottles? And so I managed to find I found a place in my book where I was able to actually cite this fact.
I mean, that sounds like a situation where the research and the idea in the end are probably pretty ridiculous. But you also give examples where, you mentioned the antibiotics, but where the idea that sounds the most ridiculous actually ends up being the best one. And one of those is how NASA got the rover Curiosity onto the surface of Mars.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite examples, partly because I was up late that night, you know, just not too many years ago, watching the feed of Mission Control as the engineers watched nervously as Curiosity plummeted toward Mars. Yeah, they had all these usual ways that they land drones on Mars, with like parachutes and airbags and retro rockets. And because of the size and shape of Curiosity and how thin the atmosphere was, none of those ideas worked. They all had problems. The parachutes wouldn't slow it down enough. The retro rockets would kick up dust and it wouldn't be able to land. It was too big for airbags. And so they had this idea that really sounded ridiculous, I think even to the engineers who were, you know, coming up with it, which was to have a hovering vehicle that they called a sky crane, which hovered on four rockets, and then it would lower the Curiosity rover, this, you know, car-sized vehicle, on a long tether toward the ground, but it would stay high enough up that it wouldn't kick up any dust. And it had to do all of this on autopilot, dangling, you know, floating in the Martian atmosphere. No one had ever landed a vehicle this way before. And it just did sound like a ridiculous idea, but it was the least ridiculous of the ideas that they could think of, because it, you know, the more they looked at every other idea that they thought was good, the more they realized they all had problems and they couldn't find any problems with the sky crane. And so they tried it and it worked. And so I always think, like, just because an idea sounds ridiculous on the face of it, it might actually have some merit to it.
You just have to work it out to its final conclusion and see. Randall Monroe is author of the webcomic XKCD. His new book is How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems. Randall, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.